completely on schedule. Our next speaker is Carol Kukrash. Carol's a very old friend of Jim's, a longtime collaborator, and I was told a longtime critic of Jim's work. That would be everybody. Now, it was this last role that particularly intrigued me because I have found it always extremely difficult to win a physics argument with Jim, or indeed any argument that is based on rationality and logic, because Jim has too much of this. And looking around, I actually found a picture of Jim from the 1960s discussing physics with a colleague who had obviously given up all hope of winning the argument on rational grounds. And here it is. That's a hammer in that person's hand. I'm sorry, it isn't quite as clear, but you can see that Jim is very useful.
Your handwriting hasn't changed at all.
No, not right. Carol is going to talk to us about ischeomorphisms, phase space, and history, and he is going to do this. I assure you, first of all, that he is not the colleague in that picture. Secondly, that he is going to give his talk without the aid of anyone this year.
Sure. I saw that cab here, and I know that in California you recycle water. Is there any water in it that I can recycle during this talk?
Let me get you some fresh water.
We're not that much of a drought right now.
I am glad that you mentioned the 60s, because that was the time when I was learning relativity. And I was learning it from a book by Christian Meller, which was very physical and tried to split everything into the space and the time. Now, I am talking here about three topics, none of which I understand in separation. And I would like to tell you what is the connection between them. And I would like to do it from two different standpoints, the Meller type standpoint and the standpoint that I learned much later, the space-time one, which I encountered for the first time when I came to the second GRG meeting in Warsaw, which only discloses how old I am if you count the numbers by now. Now, stopping in Warsaw was wonderful, because in the stores there you could get books which were unavailable in Prague in those days. And one of the books which I got was by John Singh, Relativity, the General Theory. It was relatively cheap, because Singh's name was misspelled on the spine of that book. Now, when I opened the book, the first intriguing thing that I found there was the dedication to my friends JP and JJ, who bought nothing half so precious as what they sold. Now, I thought it's a very intriguing remark, one of those Irish remarks that are private jokes, and I wondered who the friends are. Well, I was an innocent boy coming from an eastern province, and I didn't know. It was only much later when I came to the West and succumb to its decadence, that I learned the distinction not only between good and evil, but also between whiskey labels. We're trying to return back. Trying to return back to that state of primordial innocence that I lost since then, I would like to dedicate this talk to my friend J.H., who bought nothing half so precious as what he sold. And he will see that this talk, if he buys it, is no exception. Now, I would like to start with another interest of Jim Hartle, which wasn't mentioned here yet, and which occupied much of his time in the past 9 years, I presume. It is his interest in the Gell-Mann-Hartle consistent hysteresis interpretation of quantum theory. Now, as you know, if you start interpreting ordinary quantum mechanics, you work usually with the projection operators at a single instant of time. Now, in the hysteresis interpretation, you take first what is called a homogeneous hystere. It's a time-ordered sequence of individual projection operators. And you are asking the question, what is the probability that the answer to the propositions, meaning the yes-no propositions, will be yes in the course of time? To know what is happening, you must know the initial state at the initial time given by the density operator. And in the ordinary conventional quantum theory, the joint probability of finding out all of the propositions is given by the trace of an operator of the initial state sandwiched between the operators, which Jim called the class operators. Now, the class operator is a string which contains the propositions at different times, and it also contains the time evolution operator in between those times. I didn't write down the details. They are not necessary at the elementary level that I will be using it. Now, the consistent hysteresis interpretation assumes that under appropriate condition, the probability assignment which you have here is still meaningful for a closed system with no observers outside the system. By appropriate conditions, you mean that you construct an object called a decoherence functional, which is like this probability here, except that you have different hysteresis placed on the left and on the right. And you are asking whether the off-diagonal elements can be neglected with respect to the diagonal ones. Now, if they can, then this operator gives you, this object gives you the information about what hysteresis are consistent and what hysteresis can be assigned probabilities. Now, an important thing is that hysteresis can be combined by a logical OR operation. And you come from those homogeneous hysteresis to the inhomogeneous ones, which are extremely interesting because they involve something like the entanglement in the time direction, like a two-slit experiment, which you are making, though, in the time direction as well as in the spatial ones. Now, what Jim and Marie Gell-Mann did was that they took this scheme and tried to introduce hysteresis as the basic object on which everything else is later constructed. Now, there is a small modification of that approach, which was developed by Chris Isham, and which is based on the concept of the hysteresis group. What Chris did was that he noticed that the homogeneous hysteresis, those strings which I mentioned before, can be in fact associated with a genuine projection operator. unlike the class operator introduced by Jim, that that projection operator doesn't live on the single Hilbert space. It lives on a direct tensor product of the Hilbert spaces in the individual times. Now, what Chris Isham and Linden succeeded to do was to generalize this scheme to continuous histories, in which you have the time running along the real line, and you have an infinite tensor product of the history of the instantaneous spaces. Now, the key concept here is that of the history group. Now, it's analogous to the Weil-Heisenberg group in the ordinary canonical quantization. What you are doing there in the context of a single instant of time is that you start with the canonical commutation relations, say for a single particle moving on a line. And you try to consider X, P, and Y as the set of the quantities which generate an algebra. So you take the constants and you observe that they have vanishing commutation relations with the unit element on the right-hand side of the relations. Now you take this as the Lie algebra of a group, which is the Weil group, and you start representing that group on a Hilbert space. And all the canonical quantization can be considered as such a type of representation. Well, first, you see that there is a Hilbert space, which is just that of square integrable functions, which carries a unitary irreducible representation of the Weil group. And the Weil group gives you not only the space, it also gives you the privileged projection operators to look at in the histories. Now, these privileged projections, projectors are projectors in the ranges of the spectra of the basic operators which you started from. Now, the idea of Chris Isham is to take this group and just to extend it on an infinite product of the Hilbert spaces. And then what one finds is a group in which suddenly what we see are the commutation relations, not of a particle, but of a one-dimensional field theory. And that one-dimensional field theory is living on a line of time. Now, these objects are not the Heisenberg operators. They do not depend on dynamics, because there is a single delta function on the right-hand side, while if you try to calculate the commutator of the Heisenberg operators, you would, of course, get something that depends on the dynamics of the system. They correspond to virtual rather than the actual history of the system. Now, what Chris and Linden found was that you can, similarly as here, represent these operators on a bosonic Fock space, which is nothing but that continuous tensor product of the one-particle Hilbert spaces. And that you gain at the same time the privileged projectors into the ranges of the spectra of the smeared field operators on the line. It means you start working and asking questions about the time averages. Now, what I would like to discuss with you is the issue of how this approach can be extended to covariant systems. Now, there is a distinction between Isham's approach and between Gell-Mann-Hartl's approach in emphasis. Decoherent functionals of such continuous history can be written in the form in which the information about the history itself is completely disentangled from the information about the dynamics. That doesn't exist in the class operators approach, when dynamics and the histories are simply described by the same object. So what can you do by trying to introduce the history group for covariant systems? How do you treat covariant systems like a relativistic particle where you have the label time reparametrizations, or general relativity, where you have true four-dimensional diffeomorphisms in this consistent history framework. Now, here are the key points which I would like to make. The diffeomorphism invariant systems are described by means of two different but related phase spaces. There is an instantaneous phase space, which I call lowercase gamma, defined at a single instant of time, and the points on the space are constrained by the ordinary constraints that we know in general relativity. But there is a much larger space, the phase space of hysteres, which is associated with the evolution. And the hysteres are described by canonical coordinates of momenta, which are unconstrained. Now the message is, this big space carries a representation of the diffeomorphism group. And you can discuss what happens under the diffeomorphisms in the big space. But the other space, the instantaneous space, has the structure induced by the structure of the big space, and the Hamiltonian constraint in it has precious nothing to do with generating the diffeomorphisms, unlike the statements which are made usually to the contrary. Now, before I start proceeding with my technical point, let me make a remark. 9 years ago, when this type of approach to quantum theory has been initiated, when the post-Everett revolution was being started by Gell-Mann and Hartl, there was a nice little meeting held in Mazagon in Spain. And it was there that I learned from Jim and from Gell-Mann about what is happening in this field. Now, it was a very memorable meeting, not only because of its spirit, but also because of external circumstances, like a wonderful party that the community of Huelva staged for us, and on which we were entertained by the flamenco dancers and Bryce DeWitt, Mary Gell-Mann, and Steve Hawking were the three people invited to the podium and to dance with the flamenco dancers. Yes. Well, all of these things are enshrined in our memories, Jim, and it is better sometimes not to film the things. As we were returning back from that meeting, we were just passing through Seville, and it was sandwiched in between the Jerusalem lectures and the Lesus lectures that Jim gave on the subject. And Seville was preparing at that time, 1992, for the celebration of the 500 years of the discovery of this continent. So it was in a bad shape, even a worse shape than Salt Lake City is now, preparing for the Olympics. However, in Seville, I had that idea that it would be really nice to repeat that experience that we had in Huelva. And I invited Jim Hartl to join me in the evening for a flamenco show. Well, he was a little bit reluctant, I must say. His plane was leaving early in the morning, but finally he agreed. And it was a very nice show in the old quarter of Santa Cruz, with crooked streets. And after the show, I tried to walk with Jim just to the view of the main artery going to his hotel and show him the way. I believe I did it correctly. I still believe I did it correctly. We shook hands and we parted our way. Well, I learned the rest of the story only when I came back to the States. Jim gave me a talk, gave me a phone call. What happened was that somehow he wandered back into those narrow, crooked streets of the Santa Cruz Quarter, and he fell into a ditch. and he ripped his trousers. Fortunately, he didn't rip his leg. So those trousers were left over there at that time. Well, I am telling this story, of course, to embarrass Jim. I learned from Richard Price that these occasions are meant he taught me also about pants. To be to the other person savvy or civil as an orange. So this is what I am trying to do right at this moment. But there is a deep moral of the story, and this is what I would like to bring in. This moral I found posted on a fortune cookie on the door of the office of Raphael Sorkin. And this is what was on that fortune cookie. Now I need it as a reminder for myself, in fact. Because, you know, I am not here to make a revolution. I am going to work on a garden and someone else's garden. But even if you work on the garden, you do not wear your best pants. So I won't talk about the best pants which we have, which are general relativity. Slightly old-fashioned now. The fashion is for a more narrow band and with a lot of pleats. But still, we old people still wear those relativity pants on festive occasions. But I won't do it here with them. I am in my working clothes. And the working clothes is studying a finite-dimensional system. Now, in that finite-dimensional system, you start with the configuration history. You have a configuration manifold, and you have a time manifold. And you have the mapping from one into the other, which is what is meant by the configuration history. And you give me the Lagrangian action, the integral of the Lagrangian of the velocities, the coordinates, and maybe explicitly of time. Now the actual history, of course, extremizes this Lagrangian in comparison with all virtual histories with the same ends. And we know, not in the canonical language, what an infinitesimal diffeomorphism is and what it does to histories. The infinitesimal diffeomorphism of time is a vector field on the time manifold, and it acts on history simply by the Lie derivatives. On the configuration part of the history, you get the statement that the coordinates as function of time behave as temporal scalars. For the velocities, you see that they behave as temporal covectors with the derivatives going out, sitting on that line. Now in one dimension, a covector is also a scalar density. So you can do a lot of tricks there that you cannot do in a higher number of dimensions. Now change the action under the diffeomorphisms by keeping the time dependence fixed. This is given by external potentials. What you are doing is that you are changing only the histories. And when you do it, you find out that the diffeomorphism change of the action is determined essentially by the energy function of the system. For time-dependent systems, there is an additional term. Now, there are several simple observations. A general action is not diffeomorphism invariant, because this right-hand side, in general, doesn't vanish. However, if you extremize the action and evaluate the variation on the actual history, you find out that this bracket represents the energy conservation law, which is satisfied on the solutions. So every action is diffeomorphism invariant on an actual history. And the third observation is that if you want the action to be invariant, then the action must be generated by a Lagrangian which is time independent and which is homogeneous as a function of the velocities. So you analyze the statement that this bracket vanishes for all vector fields xi and all trajectories with the fixed ends, and you come to the conclusion that the Lagrangian can be always gauged into the Lagrangian, which is a homogeneous function of degree 1 in the velocities. This is equivalent to the statement that the energy function identically vanishes, which is the Euler's identity for that statement. Now, the homogeneous functions play a prominent role on all this system, the higher order ones as the lower order ones here. So if you change that power of lambda into the power n, you have a homogeneous function of degree n. Now, what is involved geometrically in these considerations is that the space which is described by the configuration carries a Pinslerian geometry. If you take the Lagrangian and if you evaluate how it changes under a small increase of the coordinate x, because the homogeneity, you can interpret this increase as the length of the element in the space. Now that assigns a Pinslerian geometry to the space. But we are usually dealing with geometries in the Riemannian sense in terms of the matrix. Is there a counterpart of the Pinslerian metric for this system? And the answer is there is. You can take the square of the Lagrangian, which is a homogeneous function of degree 2. You can differentiate it twice with respect to the velocities, and you get a metric which, however, is dependent on the direction. It is a homogeneous function of degree 0 in the variables of the velocities, and it is regular. And by the Euler identities for the functions, you can find out that the original Lagrangian is simply the square root of the metric multiplied into the velocities. You mimic, in this sense, the dynamics of a very different system from a relativistic particle by the dynamics of a relativistic particle. Now, these systems may be quite different than a free particle in general relativity. You can have a particle acted on by an electromagnetic field, or you can have an ordinary Newtonian theory which is made covariant by the adjoinment of time to the rest of the variables. And all of these can be described in terms of this line element. Now the metric here, because it is regular, enables you to convert the velocity into a type of the momentum. And what is important here, that this correlation, which on the space of configurations, simply take a configuration vector and turn it into a configuration covector, in the time sense correspond to taking a time density and then converting it into another time density. Now you can resolve the basic equation here. You can express the velocities in terms of the momenta and write this equation in terms of the metric which goes on the cotangent space. So you can turn the Pinslerian metric into the Pinslerian metric on the space of the momenta. Now, what do you do when you try to use this for the dynamics of the system? Well, one thing that you can do is to take this Lagrangian action and to extend it. You extend it by introducing an ad hoc, a virtual Riemannian metric on the timeline. the thing that didn't enter into the original scheme. And you do the extension by extending the action from the configuration space also to include the metric on that timeline. You square the original Lagrangian, you multiply it by the inverse value of lambda, and you add lambda to this. Now, in the line element here, the two types of metric, the temporal line metric, which is sitting on the time manifold, and the configuration metric, which is sitting on the configuration manifold, are in fact entirely independent. However, when you vary the action, you discover that in fact lambda is determined as an equation of motion to be equal to the Finsarian metric. So you have the statement that the time metric and the space metric coincide when you happen to be on a solution of this particular equation of motion. Now, all of you know this from the elementary mechanics when one talks about the Hertz principle. You have a free particle which is constrained to move on a frictionless surface. And you know that it moves there along a geodesic, and that the path that it covers is in fact the measure of the amount of Newtonian time that it takes. That's a specialization of this statement. The statement is in general valid everywhere. Now, if you then take this equation and substitute it back into the extended action, you recover the original action that you started from. So there is a way to pass from the ordinary action to the extended one. How do you canonize the system? You can do it in two different ways. But basically what you are doing, of course, is that you are extending the space once more from the configuration space to the velocity space, and then you enforce the velocity being equal to what is normally called velocity by a Lagrange multiplier. And then you reduce this back by eliminating the velocity through the equation of motion, and you come to the original action. So everything in this game is done by either lowering or increasing the dimension. And it has a good geometric meaning that I do not have the chance to go into. Now, when you start from the extended Lagrangian action, which is quadratic in the velocities, you can easily define what are the momenta and pass to the canonical form. And if you do it, you end with the action in which you have the ordinary Liouville term and you have the Hamiltonian. And the only place where the newly introduced time metric occurs is linear. Now, if you take the extended Lagrangian action and vary it with respect to lambda, you get a constraint on the scalar velocities. They define a surface in space called indicatrix. And it's a surface that goes back to the work of Carl Friedrich Gauss. And I learned about it when I was about 13 because my father, who was a historical cartographer, used the indicatrix all the way to indicate how the map which you make from the situation on the globe is distorted under the mapping. You are just looking at the indicatrix. But in the phase space, you have another constraint, the ordinary Hamiltonian constraint, and then the curve called a figuratrix. And the two curves are in a beautiful relationship, a geometrical one to each other. But what I want to stress is that the velocities, which are the scalar quantities, and the momenta, which are the scalar momenta, are the constraint quantities. So you have two types of velocities. One which is a temporal density, and the other one which you de-densitize by the introduced time metric. And you have the corresponding momenta, which here are scalars. Here, they are temporal densities. And you can work within the two schemes. Now you can take the Figueretrix equation and find its general solution and then express the momenta as functions of some generalized coordinates. Those generalized coordinates happen to be the density momenta, and you just introduce the scalar momenta in the way that they are constrained by the Figueretrix equation. But the density momenta are unconstrained. And similarly, when you take this equation and eliminate the constraint by its use, you cast the action to the homogeneous form in which there is no Hamiltonian, in which you have only the Liouville form, but the momenta, in fact, depend on those generalized coordinates. Now, this is quite analogous to passing in ordinary mechanics from the Lagrange equations of the second kind, which in fact have generalized coordinates and nothing is constrained, to the Lagrange equations of the first type, in which you have the constraints in the configuration space and you have a multiplier which enforces those constraints. So you have, by and large, two forms of the Hamiltonian action. One given here, here in the extended space, one given here when you resolve everything. Now at this moment, I am finally able to come to the core of what I wanted to tell you, namely to tell you what is the phase space of hysteresis. What you do is that you go to the space with those densitized unconstrained momenta, and together with the configuration trajectories, they form a single point in the space of hysteresis. And you have the Poisson bracket there, which is just the field theoretical Poisson bracket, which was introduced in the quantum mechanical context by Eichen. You can go to the space which is extended by the time metric. You need another momentum then. And you must extend also the appropriate Poisson brackets. Now, what is important is that time diffeomorphisms are in fact canonical transformations in the space of hysteresis. You take an arbitrary vector field and you then map it into a dynamical variable on the extended phase space. You do it this way. You take the densitized momenta, multiply it by the scale, by the densitized density velocities, and multiply this. Oh, I am sorry, this quantity shouldn't be here, of course. So, drop it out. And multiply it by the vector field. There is an analogous term if you want to work in the extended space. And you have the generator. That generator has the Poisson bracket, which simply replicates the Lie bracket of the two fields which you may use for the smearing. And these dynamical variables generate diffeomorphisms on hysteresis. So if you take a hystere, perform the Poisson bracket in that big space of hysteresis, you replicate the change of the coordinate, you replicate the change of the velocity. And all the actions which I wrote down, the homogeneous Lagrangian action, its canonical form, the extended canonical action, and the extended Lagrangian one, it should be probably switched. All these actions are invariant under those diffeomorphisms. So you can also see that this diffeomorphism invariance is preserved under extensions and reductions, and that the Poisson brackets are in fact preserved by the diffeomorphisms in the theory. Now, what are the equations of motion now? Until now, the scheme was kinematic. Now, the equations of motion are obtained from the Hamiltonian form, extended one, in which you work with the momenta that are densities that enter into those diffeomorphism operators. You have the Liouville form, and you have the Hamiltonian function. Given by the function of these variables, in which the second one is thought as a scalar argument, homogenized by lambda. So this is a very special type of a function. It is ultralocal, it doesn't contain any derivatives, it is homogeneous. If you multiply the momenta by a number, you multiply the Hamiltonian by the same number, and it doesn't depend on the variable that is canonically conjugate to lambda. Now, what is important is that the equations which you obtain by variations can be written down as the Poisson bracket relations in the big history space. You have, in fact, the statement that the actual history is unmoved by a canonical transformation, the infinitesimal one, which is generated by the actions, and that the equations of motion are diffeomorphism invariant. Now, when you work out what you get, when you take the history and make the Poisson bracket with these two pieces, you see that the first piece, the Liouville form, simply generates the proper velocity, scalar velocity of the particle, the rate of change of the position in the proper time on the line. And you find out that the second term, written down in terms of the Poisson bracket in space of hysteres, is in fact reducible to the Poisson bracket in a finite dimensional space of two variables called X and P, in which these variables are in fact evaluated at a single instant of the flowing time. You have the instantaneous phase space. So this is the second space which comes out from the scheme, and it is the space that carries the constraint of a particle of a general system of general relativity. So how is the big space and the small space connected? The instantaneous phase space carries an ordinary Poisson bracket, and this Poisson bracket arises from a class of very special functionals in the extended space, the big space. In this way, you give me a function in the small space. To that function, you can always correlate that ultralocal functional by plugging in here the history, densitizing, and integrating into time. So you have the mapping from the small space to the big space, and it is the mapping which preserves the Poisson bracket structure. This Poisson bracket is mapped, in fact, into the big Poisson bracket of these objects on the extended space. So you have then the mapping by which you can take the structure from the big space, pull it back to the small space, and this Poisson bracket here is just the pullback of the big Poisson bracket under the mapping H.
Sorry? In the definition of the Liouville form, why don't you have K lambda
bar? I do have, but as you look at it, this is a density. This is a density too. You must de-densitize it to get something that is invariant. You do it by that lambda. But that object which is here is just the ordinary scalar E of the ordinary theory. So I am writing the ordinary Liouville bracket, which is done by a scalar and the velocity in terms of redundant variables, a density divided by a density.
So there is an implicit gauge on
that? Sorry? No, there is no gauge there. There is the extension of the space, but when you vary on the equations of motion, you get the old relationships. Let me return back to that if you want to answer it. So what is the outcome of all of this? What is, in fact, what I would like to draw as a conclusion for the systems that really interest us? It is this. Canonical coordinates, momenta, and the constants on that big space, the space of hysteres, are the generators of the hystere group, which underlies the Eichem-Linden construction of the Gell-Mann-Hartl consistent hysteres interpretation of quantum theory. Now, we would like to see what happens to this hystere group as we come to diffeomorphism invariant systems. You remember back the story of the ordinary canonical group. The Schrödinger representation of the operators is done on the Hilbert space of square integrable functions. And you gain in this way also the privileged projectors, which are the projectors into ranges of the spectra of those operators. This is the Weyl group story. Now there is the hystere group. The hystere group operators are now field operators, and they are represented on the Fock space. And they give you the privileged candidates for the projectors. These are projectors into regions of time averages of canonical hysteric coordinates and the momenta and their combinations. In fact, in this context, Eichem and Linden worked with a different type of privileged operators into the hysteres of the coherent states. Now, what Jim did always in the context of quantizing the system, like a relativistic particle, was that he limited his attentions to alternatives that are given by configurations. He worked with the path integrals. This gives the scheme in which, when you follow the Eichem-Linden recipe, you are able to lift the alternatives to the operators which are living in the phase space. So this is a would-be phase space version of the theory of invariant diffeomorphism systems, which is done in the language that lives on a phase space. What does this all to do with the subject that interests us? When we finally put on our Sunday best, when we are having the pants that are the relativistic ones, when time diffeomorphisms are replaced by space-time diffeomorphisms. The story is effectively this. There is a space-time hysteric group in which you work with the space-time metric and the conjugate momentum, which is a density, and with the diffeomorphism with the Poisson bracket relations on the hystere space, which are in fact given by the four-dimensional delta function. You can use these momenta and these coordinates, and you can, for every vector field on the four-dimensional space-time manifold, to construct an operator which in fact generates diffeomorphisms of the general relativity or any theory in which the metric plays the basic role as the configuration variable. However, if you are trying to project this scheme and to come with the ordinary ADM formalism, you need to select a time. You need to select a foliation. And you project the metric onto the leaves of the foliation, you project the momenta as well, and the commutation relations are those of the ordinary relativity theory. Now the message seems to be this. The alternatives which are based on projectors which are associated with a given space-time decomposition of the big operators do not seem to be covariant. If you put in a different foliation and in the consistent hysteresis interpretation, you try to reduce to the first, you try to reduce to the second. You do not come with something that has an easy space-time interpretation. So the idea is you shouldn't try to base the alternatives on the scalar velocities on a given foliation. You should go back to the space-time ones and do it with the Linden-Isham program at this level. And the question is, can one base quantum gravity alternatives on the space-time hysteric group? Well, I came to the conclusion, and of course, a paper which starts with a degradation should end with an acknowledgement. So I borrowed my dedication from Singh. I am borrowing my conclusion, the acknowledgement, from the paper that Jim presented at the Lesush School and which followed that meeting in Mazagon. And in the acknowledgement, in fact, he acknowledged me. And he said what the words that I was introduced by, special thanks to Karel Kuchas, who criticized almost every paragraph. But he attributed this tendency, quite wrongly, for my wish to give a constructive criticism. That term, constructive criticism, had a very special connotation on the Communist Party meetings. And just due to my background, it's not the constructive criticism that I wanted to give. What I wanted, in fact, was something much more humble. Czechs are criticizing things because this is the only way in which they can understand them. So it was not my attempt to help Jim by constructive criticism. It was an attempt to understand what it is that he tried to tell me. And this is somehow what I try to do in this lecture, to interpret what Jim has done in slightly different terms. Now, of course, being it not a constructive criticism, I realized what the pain in the neck I must have been throughout the years, going and yapping as a little black poodle at Jim Hartle's feet. And I really appreciate his magnanimity, his generosity, and his patience for this being done to him for such a long time. And I would like to thank the rest of the audience for the little bit of patience extended for 5 more minutes than it ought to. Thank you.
The functional energy of the finite, and then define a decoherent functional by limiting the regions requiring only taking those histories for which the field has certain takes values in a certain prescribed range of the configuration space in a certain region of space-time and then another. Instead of being projection operators of given instance of time, some more generalized notion. And then, if the decoherence functional does, under certain circumstances, diagonalize and satisfies those standard rules for the joint probability calculus, then probability emerges from the formalism without having to be imposed from outside. It's an emergent concept. Maybe that's part of objective one. But what you've done is to try to justify, or is what I should tell you have done, is to try to justify this within the framework of a canonical scheme rather than a functional integral.
No, you can still work within the functional integral scheme. However, I think that what is basic for Jim's approach, and he should correct me, is that he puts the gates into the way of the three-dimensional geometries. And he sees if the path in the space of the three-dimensional geometries moves this way or that way. When he tries to construct the other observables he would like to watch, like the constraints, for example, or like the things that are momenta conjugate to the geometries, he is doing it only secondarily over a long interval of time, trying to see how to define the momenta in terms of the coordinates. What I am trying to do here is to provide the scheme with a twofold property. It enables you to work in the full phase space. So the alternatives given by the momenta are not secondarily derived by starting with the configuration space integral. And second, to do it in the way in which the momentum space is associated with spacetime rather than with a single foliation in that spacetime.
Maybe I should just make a remark to try to answer Vice's question. The idea was you should think in four-dimensional terms. Things you could calculate probabilities for were discrete morphism and variant partitions of the set of districts. And we just had configuration space histories. There was one notion. What Carl has done is to beautifully extend the thing to a notion of phase space histories, four-dimensional phase space histories, which enlarges the possible set of diffeomorphism and variant alternatives, which is usually a good thing.
Any more questions?
Well, let me just thank Carl for this exposition, right? I like to think that we've made a lot of progress together because we came often from very different viewpoints. He, as he said, from space and time, and I was always by space-time. He from the canonical approach, which I learned through him by trying, the effort of communicating was not simply one way. I learned essentially all I know about the canonical theory, talking to Carl and trying to make the connection. Indeed, just a few days ago, I found myself in an amusing situation when Abe called me in for an interview. If you want a clarification of some decade-old paper, Thomas Lima and Don Merrill, that's of course never a worrying experience. I looked over this paper with Jonathan Hallowell that I wrote. I discovered it was entirely canonical, essentially. But what Abe was asking was, how do you look at it from the space-time point of view? point of view. And so I'd like to think that we've made progress in this way, and we'll continue to make progress. He didn't mention some of the things we actually did last year on this very subject. But there are other sort of complementary principles. Bohr, for example, stressed when asked what was complementary to truth, he said clarity. That is also, on occasion, been asserted. I can just cite two examples. Right. One is we wrote one paper, and Carl, I think it's fair to say, wrote the version that contained the truth. And we together wrote the version which, in my mind, contained the clarity. And the second example was this this very long article I wrote for the Lesouch proceedings, where I attempted to sort of set out this general framework. And this was a significant effort on my part, and an even more significant effort on his, because this thing ran to, 150 printed pages or something like that. And he did carefully go through every paragraph. And I responded to whatever he said, changes. And typically, the thing was always dimensional. The truth is in the details. Right? And when I got through, I gave it back to him so he could see it, and he looked at it again very, very kindly, and he said, "You know, it's amazing how much less clear the paper is." And I think that's very true. Well, Carl, all I can say about this book is welcome to space time.
Thank you.